The second part of the interview was Tom Irwin,
at Warner Bros. Took place in New York City
on April 7th, 1988.
Before we get back to your work at the State Department from the early 70s, I have a couple questions about your law background that I want to briefly pursue. Now, former Secretary of War Robert Patterson was a founding member of your law firm, I think.
Not a founding member. The firm had been in existence since the late teens. But he, the senior member when he was in, came out of the, when he resigned from the War Department,
uh-huh,
was Chauncey Belknap.
Uh-huh.
Early in their life, they had been good friends, three good friends, Judge Patterson, Vanderbilt Webb, and Chauncey Belknap. When Judge Patterson came out of the War Department, Mr. Belknap invited him to come in to the firm and said he was also asking Vanderbilt Webb to come back to the practice of the law because he had been with the Rockefeller office, particularly with, I guess he was there with John Duke Jr. Judge Patterson said, well, if Van Webb is coming back in with you, I'll join with you too. So the three of them came together again and then sort of reconstituted the firm, but the firm had been going and Mr. Belknap had been with it for many years.
I see. But besides you, were there other members of the firm in the first 4 years who were involved in government service besides you?
Well, when I went to Washington, my first job in the Defense Department, a young man was there named Robert Knoyer, who was a lawyer. And I recommended him to Patterson, Belknap, and Webb. So when he came back to Patterson, Belknap, and Webb to practice law. He's still with the firm. And he had experience in government. At that time, I believe there was no one else that had been in the government. Since then, there have been quite a few people.
Can you give a few examples?
Well, my best example is Judge Tyler, who was a federal judge. Then he became deputy attorney general, and then he came back to practice in New York. And fortunately for this firm, he joined this firm. Now Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler. And the district attorney Giuliani came to the firm with Judge Tyler and was in the firm for a while before he went into the district attorney's office. And I'm sure as you really look through, you'd find other people that had been in and out of the office in either federal or state,
anybody
or
else,
local government.
Anybody else in foreign policy besides you? Or defense policy?
I think of no one at the moment. That doesn't mean there may not have been.
Now, in recent years, historians and social scientists have noted that a good many high-level State Department officials in the 20th century have had corporate law backgrounds. This goes all the way back to Elihu Root and Robert Lansing, up to William Rogers and Cyrus Vance, as well as Warren Christopher, his deputy. What makes corporate law a useful background for a role in foreign policy making?
I'm not so sure that it's corporate law per se.
Is
it useful?
Or perhaps law generally.
I think it more perhaps is law generally. Corporate law would be useful in the sense, to the degree that it is brought the lawyer in contact with foreign laws in other countries and negotiating abroad, that type of arrangement. The law generally, I think, is both a good background because of the training it gives a lawyer. But I would say also, there's another aspect to it. The law is an easier profession in which to go to the government and come back and have your job back again than it is in a corporate organization. If you're a vice president in a corporation and you leave for 4 years, there's no telling who may have risen in the corporation and who may be going up to a higher position, and you will have lost a certain amount of attention. It doesn't mean you wouldn't get your job back. I'm sure they, most corporations give your job back, but you may have lost out in the sense of attention as far as participation in the firm. So it's more difficult in a structured organization than it is in the law, where you, if you're a partner and you've got other partners, assuming they're agreeable, you may go to the government and then come back and go back practicing the law, somewhat like a professor.
Mm-hmm.
A professor can go into the government, spend whatever time he wishes in whatever area, he still is able to come back and pick up his teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he may or may not be able to pick up his exact post in a particular area, but it's somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm.
You take a little risk if you leave the law firm and go to the government. Maybe the firm will say, well, I don't want you back. Just like a professor might go and the university say, well, I don't have that post open anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But it essentially it's much easier than the structured organization. And so I think that's a factor rather than just the so-called legal training or the legal mind,
I see,
or the professorial mind.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, when we broke off at our first meeting, I'd asked you about the foreign policy-making process in the Nixon administration compared with the Eisenhower administration. And you just only started to answer comparing and contrasting the means of policy-making during those two periods.
Well, that... It's a difficult question, isn't it? Some degree. In both administrations, the policy was clearly the president's. President Eisenhower worked with Secretary Dulles a great deal, and Secretary Dulles carried out his policies, and I think undoubtedly helped President Eisenhower to reach certain decisions and policies. But essentially, it was President Eisenhower's policy, working very closely with Secretary Dulles. In the Nixon administration, it was President Nixon's policy, again, helped and carried out well by, in this case, Dr. Kissinger, rather than the Secretary of State. Dr. Kissinger, as NSC advisor, worked very closely with the president and was more influential in the ultimate policies, you might say, than I think the Secretary Rogers was, although Secretary Rogers had a good relationship with the president and carried out a normal policy, but for example, the areas of detente with the Soviet Union or the rapprochement with China, that was essentially President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger. So in one way you have the president working with one man in each case, each administration, but in the Nixon administration it was more tended in many cases to be Dr. Kissinger at the NSC rather than Secretary Rogers at the State. When Secretary Rogers left office and President Nixon appointed Dr. Kissinger Secretary of State, then you had more of the relationship, I would have said, that existed between President Eisenhower and President Dulles.
Now, getting into the question of Iran specifically, how would you characterize Nixon administration's, I guess, general approach towards Iran during the period of time you were at the State Department?
It would have been supportive of Iran. Not without some concern because of the autocracy of the Shah, but still generally supportive. We discussed a little of this, how it existed back in the late 50s in the Eisenhower administration, except I suppose over the years one saw more clearly that the Shah was becoming more and more absolute monarch. And there are, I would think, in broad philosophy, there might be similarities. Now, there may, must be many differences. If you go to the record, you undoubtedly would come up with, either you or I would come up with it.
Now, during your years, the period of time you were at the State Department, the U.S. ambassadors in Iran were Douglas MacArthur II, and then Joseph Garland, briefly, I guess. Did you become familiar with the work of either of them?
Well, at that time I would have been, but if you ask me just to describe it now, I would find difficulty. Yeah.
In terms of characterizing their effectiveness?
And trying to remember offhand what.
When you at this time the Iranian ambassador to the United States was Amir Asfahar, I guess in the early 70s. Do you remember much about him in particular?
I don't really recall much about him.
When you were working on Iran issues during this period, involving petroleum or other questions, who were your major sources of information? Are there any people that you dealt with in particular?
The key man in the State Department was the chap in charge of, in effect, the oil desk, and a very able fellow named Jim Akins. And within the state, he would have been the secretary's closest advisor, along with the assistant secretaries in the areas in which oil might be being discussed.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was shortly after you became undersecretary that the issues of OPEC and oil prices became a high-level concern. In the fall of 1970, Libya demanded and got an increased share of the take of its oil revenues, and this was followed by similar demands from the Persian Gulf countries in the fall of 1970. And later in that year, there was an OPEC meeting in Caracas where the members declared their intent to control the price and supply of oil over the long term. Now, did these developments come as a surprise to the State Department?
I don't think it should.
I doubt if it came as a surprise, because at least to those who were working in that area, but I couldn't really say positively.
What kind of concerns do these
Pardon?
What kind of concerns do these demands raise? Within the State Department, when people discuss them?
The question of supply and price, I suppose, are the two basic.
Well, was there much concern that countries like Libya might convince other OPEC members to use oil as a political weapon? I think there was some talk about that.
I think there would have been concern about that, but I think at that time, with the relationships that existed, there wasn't a great fear that Libya would be able to induce all the other oil states to follow its lead. So while, yes, there would have been concern, and attention, it wouldn't have been a feeling that that was likely to happen.
When these questions of oil price and supplies came up, what kinds of policy options were discussed in the State Department in terms of responding to these initiatives being taken by the OPEC members?
Ambassador Akins would be much better to answer all these questions, because I'm sure he would have more.
Yeah, unfortunately, he declined to be interviewed. So.
Background knowledge and information.
During early 71, in the wake of the Caracas meeting, John J. McCloy and the major oil firms that were in the consortium were working on a plan for the companies to take a united front, or what's called a joint approach, vis-a-vis the OPEC members. Did you meet with McCloy to discuss this plan?
Yes. Do you cover this in later questions, too?
This is probably no. This is worldly.
Mr. McCloy and some of the representatives of the oil companies came to the State Department in early 71. And if my memory is correct, which it always may not be, in effect said they were trying to get an agreement among all the countries on oil, so there would be a standard with all the different countries, somewhat you just spoken. He said there were particular questions being raised by Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, and said they thought someone should go over and discuss it with the heads of those countries from the government rather than from the oil companies. And the result was that I was sent on a ship to call the Shah, the King of Saudi Arabia, and the head of Kuwait, Sultan of Kuwait, I guess, whatever the correct title is.
Yeah, that's right.
But I talked first to I went first to Iran, then to Saudi Arabia, then to Kuwait. Ambassador Akins accompanied me, as did the Assistant Secretary for the Middle East.
Oh, Sisko.
And both were very helpful.
Would that be Joseph Sisko at that time?
No, I don't think it was Sisko at that time.
I'm not sure.
But I think Ambassador Murphy also was with us. I'm just not sure which post he was in at that time. In any case, those three countries, in effect, said that I think the oil companies in the United States are making a mistake in pushing for a unified agreement on the part of all oil states. Because if we're forced to cooperate with all the other oil states, the other states are more radical. Libya, so forth, picking out the radical state. And therefore we would end up, you would end up with an agreement that was more in accord with what the radical states wanted than what your friendly states would be willing to do. Namely, they describing themselves as the friendly states. So they said, we think you'd be better off if you made an agreement with the three of, in effect, our three states. They weren't talking together, but they were talking individually, but more or less in the same vein. Well, it made sense to me as an individual. made sense to the people that, with whom I were traveling and who were more expert in that area than I, both in oil and the political, economic field in the Middle East. So that was what I recommended, and that was what ultimately happened, that the oil companies agreed in a separate agreement with those three states. I don't know, again, the detail what followed thereafter, but I talked to, I occasionally see one of the chief oil representatives who was negotiating in Iran at that time. He lives in Princeton, New Jersey. And I asked him one day, as he looked back on it, did it ever make any real difference, the fact that I'd recommended, contrary to what they had really originally started out to do. And he said, no, I've thought about it over time, and he said, I don't think it did. So, whether who was right or who was wrong, it made sense to me at that time. That was what I recommended, and that was what the State Department recommended to Mr. McCloy and the oil company.
Now, I read that, that prior to your departure, you met with President Nixon. Did he give you any special instructions before you?
No. Not any special instructions. Congress had a hearing and they kept trying to confirm their previous opinion that there must have been a definite policy that the government wanted to take, irrespective of what the oil companies wanted, and that was not the case. I had no specific instruction to do this or do that on that negotiation mission. It was just to listen and learn and recommend. And that's what I did. And it was not a preconceived decision, although there were, ever since then, people have often thought there were.
On your mission to the Middle East, did you go to Iran first?
Yes, I went to Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait.
How long were you in Tehran? Just a few days, or?
Just a couple of days. It was just a quick visit each place.
Now, I guess you met with Ambassador MacArthur when you went to Tehran. Did you talk about the McCloy Oil Company proposal with him?
He knew about it.
Do you recall his opinion?
Pardon?
Do you recall his opinion at the time?
I think he agreed that that it would have been better to negotiate for those countries that were willing to be negotiate on a more friendly basis, as they would have put it, than trying to tie them up with the more radical states. I don't recall the specific position of the other two ambassadors, but I just not too dissimilar.
I guess I read that you met with Jamshid Amuzegar, who was the Minister of Finance in Iran at this time. You met with him before you met with the Shah. That's what I think I read in the New York Times. I looked back at the Times at that time, and they said that you met with Amuzegar and then the Shah. Do you recall anything about the meetings with the Finance Minister?
I really don't.
Yeah. After you had left Tehran, he was quoted as saying that, I don't know what Mr. Irwin's visit was for. Why would he have said that? You read anything that...
That I don't know.
You met with the Shah by yourself when you were over there?
Ambassador MacArthur came with me.
Do we call the substance of your discussion with the Shah?
Just,
like you said before.
Just what we've been talking about.
Now, according to one document that I've read, Ambassador MacArthur later said that the Shah had threatened an oil embargo if oil companies played any dirty tricks. I guess dirty tricks is a quote. Did he say anything like that to you? Possibly an oil embargo if the companies tried to take a coercive approach, I guess?
I don't recall specifically whether he said that at that time or at a different time. I don't recall myself.
Okay. Now, did the Shah, do we call the Shah make any assurances about supplies or prices in your discussions with him?
Yes, my impression was that he felt that if the oil companies negotiated with Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, they could get agreement on the price for a specific period of time, roughly 5 years is my memory.
The assumption was that there'd be a stable flow of oil in that time.
And yeah. I believe that the events pretty well carried that out, only to be interrupted by the Arab-Israeli war, and then all bets were off at that point.
What were your impressions of the Shah from that meeting? Do you recall much about that?
Well, I spoke of that earlier, actually.
That's right.
I noticed that. Having just reread it, I covered it.
Yeah.
And I really...
Were there any changes since the first time you met him that you can think of?
Well, I think, as I mentioned in our earlier conversation, I think he had become more autocratic and more I suppose more inflexible in his views once he had determined on his views. I think the sense of power was growing, as I mentioned in our earlier conversation. It seemed to bear out Lord Acton's famous dictum.
Hmm. Okay. Now, in his memoirs, Henry Kissinger sort of seemed to be maybe gently criticizing the State Department by suggesting that the... Henry Kissinger, in his memoirs, seems to be criticizing the State Department. When you met with the Shah and the other leaders in the Gulf states, you told them that the U.S. government would not involve itself in the details of the negotiations between the companies and the governments of the producing states. Kissinger says that this hands-off approach, not getting involved in the details of negotiations, meant that the companies would have to yield to the producing states in terms of prices, control of oil, and so forth. Which he suggested was the wrong way to go about it. That's the implication, I think, from reading the memoirs. Now, how would you respond to that line of approach, that line of argument that Kissinger makes?
I don't know whether I would respond.
It's just that
people think what they wish at that particular time. I think if the government were going to respond, they'd have to do it on the basis of a lot more background study and work rather than just a quick mission to discuss it and listen and learn and recommend what, as a result of what those three countries said. And if it were going to happen that way, and the United States was to take a real part, it would have been as much Dr. Kissinger's responsibility for the influence he had on policy that the president is, it would have been Secretary Rogers in the State Department. And if it had been raised, it would have been considered by all of those individuals.
But what was this, I guess, was this option of a strong government role in these negotiations, I guess, banking the oil companies, was that option discussed as one possibility dealing with the OPEC issues?
Well, I just don't recall the details. I would have thought that the government would, in broad measure, in general measure, given backing to the oil companies, but maybe not in the specifics to the degree that Mr. Kissinger speaks in that case. But I, frankly, I don't recall the detail.
Okay.
Again, you're missing your best source in the master, Aikens.
Yeah. Okay, one more question on petroleum. I guess during late 72 in the court and early 73, the Shah advanced a plan for Iran to take over the in-country operations of the consortium and compensate the companies, the consortium members, through a long-term sales purchase agreement. Do you recall your reaction? At the time, some State Department officials considered this close to expropriation, given that the consortium had a long-term contract to run oil operations in the country.
What date was this?
This is late 72, early 73.
Yeah. Well, I don't really recall the details of that.
Okay. Now, around this time, besides petroleum questions, there are other issues that involve the U.S. and Iran, such as arms sales policy issues. Did you take part in any discussions regarding arms sales policy approach to Iran? That you can recall?
It's most likely that I did, but I don't recall details.
Now, I guess maybe to refresh your memory, and one issue that came up in spring of 72 when the Shah and President Nixon traveled to Iran. When Henry Kissinger and President Nixon traveled to Iran to meet with the Shah after the Moscow summit, this is the spring of 72. And at that meeting, as you might recall, Nixon and Kissinger agreed to let the Shah buy any weapon that he wanted in the U.S. market, short of nuclear weapons, anything up to nuclear weapons for Iranian military. For the Iranian military buildup. Did you know that this would be discussed prior? Was this policy stance that they took about the Shah's ability to buy American weapons? Was this issue discussed at the State Department prior to the meeting?
I don't recall.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible that it was not. Dr. Kissinger often operated on that premise of not discussing some of the policies he and the President had talked about until it had actually been brought out into the open. They may have or they may not, I just don't really recall.
Do you recall any discussion of it thereafter, after the meeting with the Shah in Tehran?
I really don't.
Yeah. Now, during the same meetings, spring of 72, Nixon and Kissinger acceded to the Shah's request for CIA assistance to Kurdish rebels who were operating at the time inside of Iraq. Now, I think you remember at this time of the 40 Committee, which made decisions regarding covert operations generally.
Right. Could have been.
Do you recall this question of CIA aid to the Kurds came up in discussions?
I don't recall.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it didn't.
Yeah.
And when I spoke earlier, my not knowing it, it's entirely possible Secretary Rogers knew more about the trip of Secretary President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger than I might have. So.
I guess in February 73, you were appointed ambassador to France, or thereabouts. February 73?
Yes, something like that.
Did you, in the course of that year, I guess in the fall of 73, oil prices skyrocketed during the Arab-Israeli War. Did you do any work with the French on OPEC matters when you were ambassador? Any coordination going on in terms of oil policy?
Well, again, I'm sure there were just discussions, but I don't recall any specific details or specific part that I may have played.
Okay. After you left France, you returned to your law practice here in New York?
Yes.
Did you do any work or having involvement in Iran-related issues after you returned to... Do you have any comments you might want to make on subsequent developments in Iran during the late 70s in terms of U.S. policy, the revolution, and the role of U.S. policy in the 70s generally? Any observations you want to conclude with?
Well, any observations would deserve more than just offhand comment. So I think perhaps not.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Burr.